This is Betty Turnell with another oral history. Today's guest is Richard E. Reeves, sponsored both by the Decatur Public Library and the First United Methodist Church of Decatur. Well, I'm going to call you Dick, but since we're old friends, could we start by asking you to tell us something of your early life, Dick, where you were born and where you grew up?
Well, it so happens that I was born in the Macon County Hospital in Decatur, Illinois.
Well, great.
My older brother, when he was born, there was a little difficulty in the birth, and that was out on a farm near Weldon. And so when my time came, my mother came down to visit with friends in Decatur, and then I was born in the hospital here.
Okay.
That was something at that time, I guess. I grew up in Weldon on a farm to start with. My father died when I was about 7 years old, and then we moved off the farm into town, and my mother taught school in Weldon for many years, and I went to school, went to a country school for the first year, and then to the grade school in Weldon.
Well, that system must have given you a good start.
Well, I worked on the farm some in the, all through high school and that sort of thing. Also carried ice for a man out in the country when people used to have ice boxes.
Ooh.
And that sort of thing. Then eventually I stayed out of school between high school and college and worked for a year on a farm and in a filling station. And then I went to the University of Illinois. And I was at University of Illinois for 3 years, I guess. Taught in airplane mechanics in the service at Rantoul, and then down in Mississippi.
Now, this was service in the Army?
In the
aviation,
in the airport. Well, I was a civilian at that time.
Oh.
What
was this during wartime?
Just before the war began, and then for a short time I kept my civilian status and taught airplane mechanics, and then I enlisted and became an aviation cadet. Went to Yale University for a while and studied engineering there, and then was on the faculty there at Yale for a short time. Then I went to the Pentagon in Washington and worked between the Air Force and the U.S. Office of Education. I was assigned out to San Francisco and went around to all of the junior colleges and universities in 8 states out in the West to tell them how the Air Force trained young men and young women to some extent. That came from a farm or a drugstore, and how they trained them to become an airplane mechanic or a navigator or a communications person or armament or whatever.
You were helping recruit.
Well, I guess really what I was doing was, this was in the 1940s when teaching aids and mock-ups and that sort of thing were not generally used in schools, and so we had cutaways and visual charts and so forth that were not used very much in education, but the services, Army and Air Force and so forth, used these to train people rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did up till that time. Then after I got through with my military service, I came back and finished at the University of Illinois. And taught in architecture there.
Was your training in general engineering? What field of engineering?
Well, I started.
Was in the School of Engineering?
Yes, I started out in architecture, and then I had to work my way through school to earn some money to keep going. And so I transferred to agricultural engineering. And so I graduated in agricultural engineering, which is a part of the engineering school over there. But to help finance that, I got 2 BS degrees, and that last year while I was getting the second one, I taught architectural drafting.
So, you were busy.
Well, kept out of mischief. But I was I want to say too, I was active in Wesley Foundation work over there and was president of the student council at Wesley Foundation, and was influenced a great deal by Dr. Paul Burt, who was really the director of the foundation and the pastor there at the church. And I have very many happy memories of that area.
You still have an affiliation with Wesley Foundation, don't you?
Well, yes, I was on one of their trustees and on their board for a long time, but I am not actually serving with that now. But Joyce, my wife, is,
okay.
So she's on that board over there.
Well, now that we're speaking of Joyce, why don't we ask where you met?
Well, it so happened she had gone to the University of Illinois while I was in the service. I didn't know her then. But then she went down to St. Louis to take nurses training at Barnes Hospital and graduated from Barnes and Washington University. And I had a friend over there, Barbara Moody, who was also a friend of Joyce's. And I had tickets to the Plowboy Prom, which was an agricultural dance, and didn't have a date. And so Barbara said, well, I've got a friend coming up from St. Louis, and maybe you'd like to take her. And I did. It was a blind date. It was a blind date.
A very happy ending.
Well, yeah, I've been blinded ever since.
Well, and I know you have a daughter, Trish, because she spoke at the recent award banquet where you were presented the Service to Mankind Award by the Decatur Sertoma Club and the Decatur Breakfast Sertoma Club. And she gave a glowing account of your family life. Do you have other children?
Yes, we have a son, Dick Jr., who is out in the Los Angeles area. And we have a son, Jim, who is down in Florida. And then Trish, who is over in Springfield, so she's fairly close at hand.
A very nice family. Well, I know you're a member of the First United Methodist Church here in Decatur. How long have you been affiliated?
Well,
how did you come to Decatur? Let's begin with that.
Well, we had a friend, Bert Templeton, who actually, he was a member of First United Methodist Church too, and had been a friend of our families for many years. And when I graduated, or was about to graduate, at the University of Illinois, he suggested that maybe I would want to work for what was then Decatur Pump Company. And so he arranged for me to come over and have an interview, and they hired me, and so I moved to Decatur. So that's.
And that has since become Burke's Pumps?
Yes, it then it made the trade name Burke's Pump. That was the trade name. And then a few years ago, the company was sold, and the new owners called it Burke's Pumps, Inc. then, instead of Decatur Pump Company. And it's still going here in Decatur.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, now that we're talking about your career, what did you have any other positions before then?
No.
Was this your first job?
After teaching for a year at University of Illinois, then I came to Burke's. I traveled as a salesman, traveled the 11 western states from Denver to the coast and Canada to Mexico. So I traveled a lot of territory. Then I came in and was in charge of engineering for about 18 years, I guess. I was vice president of engineering. Then I moved over and became vice president of marketing and took charge of sales and advertising and service and all that sort of thing. And I did that for 18 years. Then the last couple years I was there, I was executive vice president of the company. So all that kept me out of mischief, too.
So you had a long career there.
Well, almost 38 years.
All right. We were talking about your affiliation with the First United Methodist Church. What positions have you had there, or how have you helped them?
Well, I guess I taught Sunday school, the high school and college age groups and some adult classes, and I guess I've done that for maybe 30 years, I don't know. I was in charge of the building committee that built the educational wing.
Big job.
At the church. And then I guess I've held most of the positions in the administrative board, or official board as it used to be called, and the council of ministries, and been on the pastor-parish relations committee for anyhow 25 years, I suppose, and a delegate to our annual conference for many, many years. I've gone to jurisdictional conference every 4 years since 1964, and to general conference every 4 years since 1968. I've been pretty active in the National Church as well as other places.
You really have been a pillar of the church.
Well, I don't know about a pillar, but maybe.
We'll talk later about your work with UMCOR, which is a division of the United Methodist Church. But let's talk now about how this all came about. You were retired, you said, or I suppose just might say semi-retired.
Active retirement.
Active retirement. But the Sertoma Clubs acclaimed your work in Africa. Now, can you tell us about what you've been doing in Africa?
Well, I've since I retired in March of 1985, which is just a little over 3 years ago now, just about 3 years. I've been to Africa four times. I've gone for UMCOR, United Methodist Committee on Relief, three of those times to do feasibility studies and to help get projects going on there, in wells. They have tremendous water problems, and in sanitation, building latrines and that sort of thing. And I worked in Sierra Leone and in Liberia, in Ghana, and in Kenya. So I've seen, this is kind of what's called West and Central Africa, and of course Kenya is in East Africa. I've been to Kenya twice, but one time my wife went with me, Joyce, and we attended the World Methodist Conference, and then took an eight-day safari afterwards. So we saw the animals and took a hot air balloon ride out over the where the Maasai live, and had a wonderful time there. So I've, most of my work over there, though, has been with the people out in the so-called bush, trying to get them water that doesn't have to come from a stream or a seep hole or that sort of thing. It's very primitive. The people are very poor and need help, and I'm able to help them. So
well, great. At the Sertoma Award Dinner, you spoke of some of the conditions that you found there, and how you were able to help them. Could you tell us any stories about what you've experienced there?
Well. There are studies that I have not made, but I've read people from the United Nations and from CARE and so forth have made surveys, and they've determined that less than 2% of the people who live in the so-called bush or up in the provinces of most of these countries, less than 2% have what we would call potable or pure drinking water. And so the need is very great, and the lack of sanitation, the lack of knowledge of hygiene and that sort of thing results in the fact that in the district I was in Sierra Leone, the Mayamba district, just this past winter, about a third of the babies that are born die before they're 4 years old, because of the conditions in which they have to grow up. And so the needs there are just tremendous, and the equipment or tools or the know-how to solve their problems just doesn't exist there unless someone comes over and helps train them and point the way, and also supply the tools and equipment and oftentimes the materials that are needed to for construction, for example, cement and reinforcing bar and that sort of thing.
How did you get those supplies?
Well, you have to order them from Europe or United States and then have them shipped over there, which takes a good deal of time. The other thing that makes it so necessary for UMCOR or church groups or United Nations or governments to help is that the economy is so bad that their currency, for example, in Sierra Leone, the currency is called the leone, and it is the country is bankrupt, and so the leone is not recognized by anybody else in the world. And so when you want to buy equipment or supplies or tools or whatever, you have to come up with dollars or pounds or marks or francs or whatever. And so the supply of the money to buy these things has to come from outside of Sierra Leone. They don't have the money, and they don't have a way. They don't export enough stuff to get hard currency to keep the thing going. So it's a real problem.
How did you get along with the people?
Oh, they're lovely, lovely people. They're really, in spite of all their poverty and the fact that they just don't have the material things that we think are necessary for life, they're a happy, joyous people. They, of course, live in an entirely different situation than we are here. They don't have the kind of foods that we have. Many of them only eat primarily one meal a day. And of course, rice is a basic food. And if they don't have rice at that main meal that they have each day, they don't consider that they've eaten. Mm-hmm. Now, they may also, during the day, suck on an orange or eat a banana or a few what they call groundnuts, peanut type thing, to help. But normally, what we would call a decent meal, mm-hmm. many of them have just one a day. And it's a different way of life.
And before you came there, how did they get water?
Most of them, they would have to walk to a stream. And of course, that stream is used for everything, where they do their laundry and where they take their bath and so forth. And as the stream goes on down to the next little village, why, they use the same water over and over. Sometimes, particularly in the dry season, many of those streams dry up. And then there might be a place in the woods or someplace at the bottom of a hill or a mountain where there would be a seep hole, like a spring, although it is a seep hole, not a running spring. And that water, they would walk maybe 3 or 4 or 5 miles or even farther sometimes, carry a bucket of water or a pan of water on their heads back to their hut or village, wherever they lived, and you don't waste water when that happens. And the women and children do most of that water carrying, and actually they spend a great deal of their waking hours just getting water for the family. Often, as I indicated earlier, since only 2% or less of them have what you call pure kind of water, often that water that they get is polluted, and they don't heat it to boil it or purify it that way, and don't have any other way of purifying it. And to some large extent, they don't even realize that the water, it's wet, and in many places it's pretty clear looking. They don't even realize that it is polluted because they can't see anything in it, they have to be trained to know that they need to purify it in some way. So that's a part of the whole training, the whole hygiene of the thing. Even when you put a well in, these are hand dug wells that we're putting in. They don't. oftentimes they'll come to the well with a pan or a bucket that has not been cleaned out and it's dirty. They may take it back home, and even if the bucket was clean, the children may play with it, the chickens or the goats may get to it. So hygiene, they have to be trained about hygiene and sanitation and all those kinds of things. And over the course of time, CARE and the people from the United Nations and Peace Corps and other places have learned that you really have to start out by training them about hygiene and sanitation, because you can go to the trouble and dig a well or drill a well or whatever and have pure water, but if they don't take care of it satisfactorily after they get it, why, you didn't help them any.
Were you ill there?
No. Every time I've gone, I've stayed in pretty good shape, but I watch very closely what I eat and what I drink and that sort of thing. And you can, in the major cities, you can buy bottled water. That so far I've found to be all right. And you can get Coke or 7-Up almost anywhere, even out in some very remote villages. I don't know how it ever gets there, but you can get a Coke or 7-Up. It's warm because they don't have refrigeration. There's no electricity, of course. And but you can get liquids that way. I don't eat leafy vegetables, but oranges, bananas that you can peel. And they raise yams and cassava, and they have swamp rice and those things. So you can get something to eat. Yeah, that's what they say. When you ask them, they don't have any money, they don't have anything to go with. And I say, how do you get along? Oh, we manage.
when you came, what your object was to give them wells?
The object was, yes, to get some wells dug.
And how were these operated then? You said you didn't have electricity.
Well, you have to dig them with a pick and a shovel. And they're about 4 feet in diameter. And a man or even two men can go down in the wells. They dig down 40, 50, 60 feet down to what we call the water table, or where the water is. And then over the years now, we have learned to teach how to line the well with concrete, reinforced concrete. And they put a well head at the top of the well and cap it, so that it doesn't get contaminated so easily. And now we are putting hand pumps on. But oftentimes, if the hand, particularly if the hand pump breaks or something goes wrong, then there's kind of a manhole in the cover of the well, and they use a bucket and rope. Mm-hmm. And a great many wells are bucket and rope type. Mm-hmm. Wells that never have had a hand pump on them because they're not available, or they've had a hand pump until it breaks and then they have to go back. Mm-hmm. And there they have to be trained that the bucket that they use has to be clean. Don't throw it in the dirt. Mm-hmm. And drag it along, and the rope, you don't let it lay out in the dirt where the animals are and that sort of thing, and that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And even in the schools, now we were digging a well at a Mayamba boys secondary school, and there also was a well there at a Harford girls school. But these are high school age kids, and even though they're told to, you know, try to some of the things about hygiene and how to keep things sanitary and so forth, they forget, and they drop the bucket in the well, and they throw it around and play with it and so forth. So it's a continuing problem, as you would see.
Well, what was their reaction after you gave them this water, brought them this water?
Oh, they're very, very, of course, they're very happy you know, not have to walk and hunt and sometimes not find water, particularly in the dry season. But there is also a situation where many of these people are organized into tribes or villages and this sort of thing, and there's a village chief. And sometimes the village chief and the elders, all of them are men, of course, and sometimes they decide that they don't want a well in their village.
Why?
Or their community. Well, they wonder what the women will do. See, they don't.
Women's work.
It's women's work, and if they have to walk 4 or 5 miles to go get it, it keeps them busy, I guess, as if they didn't have anything else to do.
Oh.
But this is their. I ran into this, I guess, the first time, really, when I was in Ghana, and there was a village there where there were some ladies with the Wycliffe Bible translators who were living in this community, and they would very much have liked to have had a well close by instead of having someone, a houseboy or someone like that, walk 2 or 3 miles to a stream to get water. They would like to have had a well in the village, but the village chief there would not let them have a well, just because he wanted to keep what would the women do? but I have to say on the other side of that in order for the women to have any sort of social life, to where they can converse with each other and have get away from the old man, if nothing else, some of them preferred to walk to the water hole rather than to have to do the drudgery work around the house and take care of all the children. And although oftentimes, or most times, I guess, the children would go with the woman to the water source. She'd carry one on the back.
But at least it was an outing.
It was an outing and a little bit of social life for them that they could have.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting thing to observe, anyhow.
Well, at the banquet, we were told that you acted as a kind of ambassador for these African countries. What did they mean?
Well, I don't know. I guess if you go and carry some of the culture that we have, and certainly some of the religious ideas and faith and commitment, I suppose in a sense you're an ambassador.
Brought good hope and goodwill to these people.
Well, yes, that's right. And one of the things they need is hope.
Mm-hmm.
And unless people from the outside world bring them that hope, they don't have any reason to think that they ought to have any hope. They somehow can't seem to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. And unfortunately for many of these people, colonialism over the many centuries, I guess, really, never taught the native people, didn't educate them, didn't teach them to look after themselves in the sense that we have learned to do it. And consequently, they still look to outsiders to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And there are increasing numbers of the young people, particularly, that are being educated in oftentimes missionary schools that the government may help pay the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And so forth, but more and more people are being educated now, and from my standpoint, the fact that the church has been responsible for a lot of this education gives them a certain love for the church and what it stands for, and people who are in control of government and responsible positions, more and more of them have been educated in Christian schools. Although the Muslims, who, for example, in Sierra Leone, over 40% of the people are Muslim, less than 10% are Christian, and the Muslims have adopted many of the practices of the Christian people now, so that they have elementary and secondary schools now.
Good.
And they have an evangelistic effort.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of thing. And
this is a very practical way of missionary work, isn't it?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, since I'm an engineer and know something about wells and water and that sort of thing, it seems a natural thing for me. I suppose some people would say it's a call, I don't know, but But anyhow, it's a natural thing for me to go and be helpful in that area. And as someone said over there, that we don't, one of the missionary women over there said, we don't come over here to convert people. We come over to witness, and then God and the Holy Spirit do the conversion. We don't convert people. We witness, and they're converted by God.
Now, we mentioned UMCOR. Perhaps we could say a little bit more about that association.
Well, UMCOR is United Methodist Committee on Relief, and it is really a division of our Board of Global Ministries, and its main emphasis is to help people in this country and across the world who have real problems, such as disasters and very critical times. If there's an earthquake or a famine or a flood or that sort of thing in various parts of the world, then UMCOR, through their the money that they raise from across our denomination, and through the expertise that various people who are associated with UMCOR have, they help those people. When the Mexico City had that very bad earthquake 2-3 years ago, they were there. When there are floods, wherever they are in this country or across the world, they help. The famines that we hear about in Ethiopia and Sudan and those places in Africa, they've been at the forefront of that. They send blankets, and they send food, and they send people to help, and doctors and nurses and that sort of thing. And our whole denomination here in this country, of which there are probably, 38,000 churches or whatever, by giving to the Board of Global Ministries and through the advance to UMCOR, help fund this type of activity. So each of us, can be a missionary in that sense, and goodness knows it's a helpful thing. Saying when we give to UMCOR, we've always been told that 100% of the dollar that we give to the advance, for example, if you're giving it for hunger or for a disaster, a flood or an earthquake and so forth, 100% of those dollars go to the project. All the administrative costs and that sort of thing are taken care of in other ways.
But we have often heard of the way that governments over there may misappropriate some of the funds.
Yes.
Is that a fact? Or?
Oh, I'm sure it is a fact, particularly when we have money or supplies and so forth given from government to government. But as we give through the church, then we work through the church in these countries. And so that's another thing. If we had to pay for the volunteerism that is here in this country and over there, we couldn't afford very much.
But your work was volunteer.
It's volunteer work, yes. That's part of what I can do. We ought to pay a little bit for the space we take up on Earth.
Yeah.
So I guess that's how we do
you
it.
You are certainly doing your share. But now, you mentioned, how can other members of the public help Africa?
Well, a great many, an increasing number at least, of people go over on work teams now. And while I was in Sierra Leone this past winter, we had work teams there from Pennsylvania and from Indiana and Kentucky and Tennessee. Some of them come over to help in building latrines and dormitories and that sort of thing. The group from Indiana, both conferences of our church in Indiana have committed themselves for a number of years now in a program that they call Operation Classroom. And what they're doing is they're supplying books and tablets and pencils and rulers and that sort of thing to a number of schools in both Sierra Leone and in Liberia. And then they are going over there to, in some cases, help repair, in other cases, help build schools or places for the some of the teachers of the schools mm-hmm. to live in. And the repair work that needs to be done in many of these places is for the schools is, you just can't imagine how badly it's needed. They need blackboards and all of the things that makes a school go. They also, the Indiana people, are also giving money to a fund over there so that it's a revolving fund so that the teachers will be paid. In Sierra Leone, for
example, the native teachers?
The native teachers. They may be 2 or 3 months behind mm-hmm. in receiving mm-hmm. pay. Mm-hmm. And their pay, it doesn't amount to hardly anything anyhow, but it's all they have. It might be $30 or $35 a month. But then when they haven't had it for 2 or 3 months in a row, they're just almost destitute mm-hmm. to how to get along. And so the Indiana people have made a contribution in Sierra Leone there to a revolving fund. So while the government may be delaying their payment of the salaries, they use this developing fund to pay the teachers and then replace it when the government finally has enough money to help pay them. It's just amazing how those people get along when they haven't any income for a period of time.
Well, Dick, we know that you've served other organizations, community organizations. In 1987, for example, you were named Rotarian of the Year. What other groups have you served?
Well, I've been involved in several things, I guess. I was on the board of the Webster Cantrell Hall, which is originally was a place for boys and girls who were orphaned, and now are some unwanted children, or children who have been in trouble with the law, maybe, and this is a home where if their parents don't want them, or they're not existent, or run off, or whatever, they look after them. I've also been involved with what was called day probation for high school age students who were in trouble with the law, maybe for the first time, and needed to have training other than going to our public schools. I've been involved, of course, with Rotary. I'm in several things there. At the present time, the Rotary clubs across the world are trying to stamp out polio, which is pretty well non-existent in our country, but in other countries of the world is still prevalent, and so our intention is to give the vaccine to every baby across the world here and accomplish that in the next few years. I guess I've been involved in YMCA work, and I don't know.
Well, you've
all.
Been busy.
I've been busy. Keep out of mischief.
And very helpful. What are your plans for the future?
Well, I'll keep involved as long as my health is good, I guess. When I go to these other countries, for example in Africa, you have to be invited. You don't just pick up and go. And I plan to continue to be a consultant to UMCOR, and when they need me and when my so-called expertise would be helpful, I may go back to Africa, mm-hmm. I may go someplace else. As I say, I'll keep going as long as my health lets me do that, I guess.
Well, that certainly is great. We joined the Sertoma Clubs in celebrating your work, Dick, and we feel that you really have made a great contribution. And thank you very much for sharing your reminiscences with us. This is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library and the First United Methodist Church of Decatur. You have been listening to the experiences of Mr. Richard E. Reeves.
Thank you very much.